Yeah, that's a really powerful question.
That's a beautiful question.
That's a very wise question, Lauren.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio, and by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. I'm Lauren Korn, speaking with Nathaniel Ian Miller about his novel, Red Dog Farm. This is the story of Ori, the son of an Icelandic farmer who leaves his family farm to attend university in Reykjavik, only to return after one semester in the city in order to join his father, who at this point finds little joy in farming. Writer Paul Harding says of the novel, "Red Dog Farm is a gorgeous, intimate, elemental, and deadpan funny novel that renders the bleak, unromantic, and very often unrewarding work of maintaining a small family cattle farm in Iceland. It also portrays artfully, almost miraculously, how there is, at the heart of such grit and misery, a stark and enduring, beautiful and priceless human dignity." We're about to get into the grit, into the misery, into the miraculous here shortly. Nathaniel, thank you so much for joining me. Welcome back to The Right Question.
Thanks, Lauren. It's my pleasure to be here.
I wanted to begin our conversation with an excerpt from this book. Will you read a short passage that begins on page 7 with "Adults Ask Kids"?
You got it. "Adults ask kids what they want to be when they grow up. And for a long time, I said, farmer. But Poppy took pains to disabuse me of romantic notions. And if I thought a task was at all difficult, and I expressed this dissatisfaction, he was bound to remind me that farming was made up of unpleasant tasks, one after another, and eventually I stopped saying it. I didn't really know the place, the work. That wouldn't come until much later, 2013, the year I turned 21. Maybe I arrived late, maybe I took too long to understand, to mature. It's a maxim about bull calves. Why shouldn't it be true for bull children? But a kid takes his surroundings for granted. He's not aware of the labor, the sacrifices, or even that a farm is something singular, a world unto itself. How can he embrace the thing when he can't see well enough to wrap his arms around it? And there was no guarantee that I ever would. Farm-raised children don't grow up to farm much more often than farm-raised eggs grow up to be chickens. Anyone who spends more than a moment looking backward knows that inevitability is a fiction. No norms, just opportunity, blood, and choices."
We will get into the blood and the choices of it all soon enough. But I wanted to ask you first, Nathaniel, how did this novel begin for you? Did it begin with an image of a farm or of Iceland, of this kid, Ori, struggling against certain expectations or inheritances? Or did it begin with his dog? I'm curious about where the spark of this novel came for you.
Sure. Kind of in a couple different places, all sort of coalescing. The first was it came from a place of guilt and shame, and that I had written my previous book, The Memoirs of Stockholm Sven. And, you know, I think I'm not spoiling anything by saying that Sven ends up in Iceland towards the end of the book for a period and dislikes it intensely. And really gives it short shrift. And, you know, I can't say why he said that or I said, because I have to take the blame. But I did, after the fact, feel somewhat guilty about that. Like, that was unfair to the nation of Iceland, maybe. And I think I felt that way after we took independently, and this is before Sven came out, a family trip to Iceland. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you know, like everybody else who goes there, not in the wintertime, I'm looking around marveling at its exquisite beauty and thinking, all right, you know, I did an injustice. Maybe I can remedy it somehow. And also on that trip, we got to go to the Westman Islands, which come up later in this book. It's a tiny little archipelago just south of the mainland of Iceland. It's the site of a massive volcanic eruption in 1973. And it's hard, hard to put into words. I guess I did attempt to put it into words just how striking a place it is in terms of, this little volcanic chain. And only one of the islands is inhabited, and that's the one that had to be evacuated, completely evacuated, as this new mountain was created right in the midst of it. And we're talking small islands. And we got to visit, and I heard the story that there's a volcano museum there, and it's fascinating. And one of the sort of the prevailing narrative about the evacuation is that it was this amazing example of human cooperation. And there was no loss of life during the evacuation. It was really, slow, steady, calm. There was one person who died a little while later, not part of the evacuation, but that was the only fatality, except for the animals. So they, it was a very big sheep farming island, like most of Iceland, and all the sheep were airlifted, and the horses were taken out on ships, and the cows were all killed. They were too heavy, too expendable. Not very many of them, but that story stuck with me. I later confirmed it with the former mayor of that town on the island, and got a few more details. And anyway, that was really the thing that started the gears turning in my mind. That image, who would have had to do that? Who would have had to make that decision? Who would have had to carry it out, the killing of these cows? And for a while, that was going to be just a short story, and then everything kind of moved from there.
Well, let's talk about the way that you've sort of fictionalized or represented this particular history in the book. This book is written from Ori's perspective, all except for one chapter, which comes late in the book. Poppy is telling Ori about this childhood homeland, this remote island, this evacuation, this very slow but steady evacuation. I'm curious what led you to make this chapter one not from Ori's perspective, but of like a storytelling, an oral telling from Poppy's perspective. And it sounds like because it was the impetus for this book and sort of began this book, is that a chapter that you wrote early on?
That's a really good question, Lauren. So it was not one I wrote early on, but I knew I'd get there somehow. Initially, once it stopped being its own short story, and I started getting interested in telling more of a farming story, more of a present day story, it was going to be about half the book, and maybe half told in flashback, back and forth to Poppy's childhood leading up to the eruption and the evacuation. And maybe because I remembered that I dislike flashbacks, or I dislike reading them, I dislike writing them, it got smaller and smaller, but I knew it had to appear somehow. And eventually it made sense for it to appear later, not as a revelation, but as this kind of, and I definitely gave myself some kind of liberties because it's a stylistic, as you said, a tonal change, a narrative change, and it's abrupt. It comes and it's over. For me, the way I was thinking about it, and I'm really hoping this doesn't sound totally pretentious, but I was thinking of it in a kind of stagey way. There's this, it's almost a trope of Irish theater, which I is one of the only kinds of theater I still enjoy, where like Conor MacPherson, as a playwright I love, and a lot of his stuff, like The Weir, it takes place in a pub in the middle of nowhere, and you're kind of watching the story unfold. You're in the dark about a lot of it, and then there'll be this late in the play, sort of third act. And it is a sort of revelation, but it'll be, one character talking, like just this, and I Maybe this doesn't exist in the weird at all, but it's how my brain sort of has held on to it as this kind of very stagey monologue. And at a, you know, that to me ended up being the only way it felt right. I didn't want to tell it in dialogue or as a flashback necessarily. I wanted to have this kind of, as you know, as you said, I think, a kind of oral storytelling feel.
So let's talk about this idea of the cows being the only animals that didn't make it off this island and the violence inherent to that idea, that story, that history. Ori's father, again, Poppy, is going through it in the space of this novel. He's depressed, he's quite despondent. We learn through a number of conversations with other characters that he, mostly his son, really, but he's reckoning with this idea of animal cruelty and animal pain. And this family farms Galloway cattle. So he's confronted with livestock, with cows on a daily basis. And you write about these reckonings really, really eloquently. I didn't mean for us to go back into the book so quickly, but would you mind reading a couple more paragraphs from the book, beginning on page 171? And if you could read basically that page down to the big needle sideways.
You got it.
Thank you.
Violence was inherent to farming. No one could argue with that. But he tried so hard over the years to cultivate an operation, an environment in which its presence was minimal. He'd seen countless farmers do things the old way, and the old way resulted in injured people, frightened animals, or dead versions of both. If he treated the animals with respect and kindness, even though they might be destined for the abattoir, wasn't that enough? What constituted a good life? How did an animal make it clear that it wasn't having a good life? By kicking the hell out of you? By breaking your spine? Violence was everywhere. It grew in the soil like Clostridium spores. Some things turned up the same no matter how you went about them. Poppy had been forced to intubate a surprising number of calves over the years when they couldn't or wouldn't nurse, an experience that he always described with rueful horror, for it was excruciating, an absolute nightmare to the calf whose life he was desperate to save. Or why did it often happen that the friendliest cattle were also the most perilous? They feared him less, so they'd dance and leap and kick and even headbutt at his approach, 600 kilograms of joy. And then, of course, he resented them for jeopardizing his life. This contradiction, the feeling of antagonism, hatred even, for creatures in whose health and happiness he was so invested, plagued him. If there'd been a vaccine against it, he would have pinched up his own skin and plunged the big needle sideways.
You're listening to A Conversation with Nathaniel Ian Miller. I'm Lauren Korn. This episode of The Right Question is supported by Chapter One Bookstore in Hamilton, Montana, a literary and community resource for the Bitterroot Valley, providing space to explore, discover, and share passions since 1974. More information can be found at chapter1bookstore.com. We learn, and again, this is later in the book during Poppy's passage, that the despondency or the depression that Poppy is dealing with is more maybe related to these foundational traumas, this history on this island, than we might have thought. As a farmer yourself, Nathaniel, will you talk about these questions as you have had to contend with them? What questions you hoped, if not to answer with this book, what questions you wanted to approach with this novel?
Sure. And I mean, I think I'll try, although I think it's impossible to answer any of those questions. I poured all of them into this book. Every question that came to me in the course of 10, 11 years of having livestock here. And yeah, I think they're impossible questions, but they were things that I grappled with over the years, particularly this idea of violence. And could you ever farm livestock in such a way that you could get away from it? And I think the answer I came up with was no. Or maybe I came up with it repeatedly and hoped the answer might change. No, never. And year after year, I felt my resistance to it or my ability to withstand it on a sort of emotional, psychological level was dwindling to the point where I, like Poppy, wanted out of the livestock business, not of life. And I did. Who knows what I'll do next here. I mean, we're still making hay and whatnot, but I did get rid of the animals. And for much the same reason and in much the same way that Poppy did, I kind of just stopped increasing. You know, if you're not constantly working on the next year's sort of genetic preparations, then everything kind of grinds to a halt. And so all the nightmares, all the violence, all the tragedies, that's what built the hard truths of farming that are in this book. And I talk to my friends who still farm, and I wonder, you know, how they're doing. And we talk about it very openly, and I'm in no way judgmental of anyone choosing to still do. And of course, it's essential that people who continue to eat meat or dairy or whatever the case may be have a more keen understanding. And so I think that was something I also set out to do, was put it a little in people's face. There is much romanticization of farming that goes on, and you know, it starts at a young age with the indoctrination through these board books of these beautiful bucolic farms, and everybody's happy. And you know, as a farmer with a kid who's now 12, but we went through those books, and I was always like puncturing the dreams and disabusing my son of his illusions, even because he would have the illusions, even though the hard truths are right out his window or door. It's that powerful. And so maybe I'm doing my own little part to kind of lance that.
You went to Iceland, where the seed of or the kernel of this idea was formed. Did you do further research when you decided to kind of full steam ahead with this novel?
Yes, and I had to wait a couple of years because of COVID. So when we'd gone as a, I don't know, just a family vacation, that was the fall of 2019, and then, you know, boom. And so it was a few years later, and I was already pretty deep into the story, relying heavily on memory and photographs and a few notes here and there, and whatever I could dig up, when I got to go again on my research trip. And what made it so effective was that in the meantime, I had become friends with the great Icelandic actor, Dari Ólafsson, who's on Severance. And he had read the audiobook of the Memoirs of Stockholm Sven, and because I begged him to. And then he read this one. And in the meantime, he was thrilled that I was interested in writing about Iceland. Reassured me that not too many Icelandic people would be really pissed off about it, and or take great offense to all the various mistakes and generalizations I made. You know, he was excited, and he proved the kind of ultimate fixer in that, you know, he knows everybody, and he put me in touch with this guy Gudmundur Thorvaldsson, Gudmi, another friend now who grew up on a farm in exactly the part of the country that I wanted to write about. He took me around, told me a thousand amazing stories, explained all the ins and outs. Both guys read the manuscript when it was before I'd ever sent it out, and you know, helped me with the thousand mistakes I made and pointed out various liberties I'd taken, some of which I left in. And so that's why the research trip was, instead of me just kind of, as I would usually do, just wander around and look at stuff, I got to talk to the right people and gather the right information.
Because he voiced both of these books. I'm curious about his influence on the stories. Mm-hmm. Is there something that he brings to them that isn't inherent in the writing itself?
I absolutely believe there is. I mean, as someone who adores audiobooks, and is therefore intensely particular about who the reader is and how they do it.
Yeah.
And made myself a real pain in terms of getting him to read the first one. A pain to my publisher, I mean, because I'm so particular. I am someone who gets an extra, several extra layers of enjoyment and depth out of a book when it's read really well. It's just, there's no substitute for me. I love to read, of course, but when I'm listening and that reader is spectacular and they're just, it's like this, it's this godlike breathing life into characters and also sweeping me along. As someone who reads very slowly and tends to circle back again and again and again to the same sentence, the same paragraph, and I'm picking it apart and I'm maybe I'm loving it, maybe I'm critiquing it, but I'm moving very slowly. And that can take away from the momentum of a book and therefore the enjoyment. Whereas with a great audiobook, I'm swept along. Maybe I space out for a few minutes. It doesn't matter. I'm still with it. Like I'm listening to Zadie Smith right now read The Fraud, and I'm just, she's unbelievable. She's unbelievable as a writer and as a reader. I mean, talk about a double threat. And so yes, in terms of, I mean, I don't know how a great actor like Dario Olufsen does his art. That's a mystery to me. The things, the emotions that he's bringing to it, the truths, the depth, the gravitas, the charisma, but he sure does. And I mean, I know there are a bunch of writers who can't stand to listen to their own audiobooks, and maybe that's healthy because you know, who really wants to hear their own writing? But when it's done this well, I mean, I don't know. I've listened to it once. I'm sure I'll listen to it again. I just, to me, with Sven, it was the best part of the whole process. And again, best part, easily, listening to him just give life to these characters.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's move again a little bit broader into your book, Red Dog Farm. This is a name, a phrase that doesn't actually appear in the novel until the end of the book, but it's an homage, again, to Ori's dog, a Kelpie. How did you see Riku's role in the book? How did you want her presence in the book to either direct the plot? I mean, the novel is almost named after her, or enliven the characters in the book.
Mm-hmm. Well, first the title thing. I mean, that was a late move. You know, I think I submitted something like 40 title ideas, none of which had anything to do with the dog. And, you know, because of my predilections and interests, most of the titles that I submitted were kind of dark and heavy and bleak, and as I was told by the marketing people, Little Brown, you know, off-putting.
Oh.
And this and that. What they wanted was something both exotic and warm, which is a hard balance to find. And I failed again and again and again.
Especially for a book about Iceland.
I know. And they didn't want any Icelandic words in the title, which ruled out a number. And they didn't want words like grit or wind or weather. I mean, I was leaning on those types of things. And so when I thought of the Red Dog Farm, I thought, I think they're going to like this one. And they did. To this day, maybe I have a little bit of regret. It was originally called Grita, which is an Icelandic word meaning rocky.
Yeah.
And I liked the double meaning of Grita and grit. And I still kind of missed that title. My son doesn't hesitate to remind me that he thinks that was a better one, which at this point is like, thanks a lot, pal, you know, too late. But I couldn't make them buy it. But as far as the dog herself goes, And boy, talk about a contrivance. I doubt there is a Kelpie on the island of Iceland. One, not one. I mean, I would be very surprised. I hope somebody proves me wrong. There are Galloways, a bunch, but yeah, no Kelpies that I ever heard of. There are border collies. But again, like with Sven, I'm kind of on a mission to include animals where I feel like there always are. And as someone who gets frustrated and yells at the TV or whatever, or a book, when there's a scene and there's obviously there would have been a dog or a cat in that room, and where is it? And are they introduce a dog and then it's gone, so either animals as plot devices, which I'm allergic to, without depth, without agency, without three dimensionality, or just missing animals, something I'm always trying to correct. And because, for most of us, they're a huge part of our lives. And if we're not looking at the person we're addressing or something, we're looking at the animal. And when they're gone and they die, there's a hole. And we are forever aware of that hole. And I hope no one's getting nervous. The dog does not die in this book.
True, yeah.
Yeah. So again, trying to build a full animal character and really make it her stand on her own against the human characters, have some agency, not there to move the plot, not there to pull the heartstrings, just another person in the room.
I love that. I love that. Is there anything else about Red Dog Farm that we haven't talked about that you want to make sure our listeners know before we end our conversation today?
One thing that let me write this book that I didn't predict was, and I was reading a bunch of this Icelandic author who I adored named Jón Kalman Stefánsson, and particularly a book he wrote called Heaven and Hell, which I name drop in this book. I wanted to use something from that as an epigraph, but I got mired in the rights process. But he has a unique style, and like much Icelandic fiction I've read, and like the sagas, there's this kind of incantatory rhythm without hard stops that I originally, I was hearing, I was absorbing. And so I, despite being a lifelong, really annoying grammarian who, I taught at the writing center at UM. And, it's, one thing I really couldn't tolerate was comma splices. And as anyone who will read this will find out, I spliced the hell out of this book. I mean, so many
So
splices.
many.
And boy, did the copy editor not like that. And through doing that, through allowing myself to just.
That was Nathaniel Ian Miller, author of Red Dog Farm, out now from Little Brown and Company. To listen to this conversation again, to share it with friends, or to learn more about Nathaniel, head to mtpr.org. You've been listening to The Right Question. This episode was produced by Chris Moyles and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Chris also engineered this episode. The artwork for The Right Question was designed by Molly Russell. Funding for The Right Question is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008, and thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.